to you from the back corner of your bra drawer, it's the Liberal Arts.
A podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
How long has it been since you watched any of these?
Ew. Hi everyone, I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
I'm Rissa.
And I am not.
Caitlin!
I have one job! Okay. Oh, sorry, I'm Caitlin. Hi.
Hi, Caitlin.
Hi, Caitlin.
Welcome here. Welcome to the Liberal Arts, our very first ever special guest.
Huzzah!
Hey! Awesome. Yay! I don't know what to say here. Thank you to the Academy.
The Academy is apropos, right? Because we're going to talk about movies today, is that right?
Yes, we are going to talk about movies.
Do you want to introduce yourself? Thing. Like, what do you know? Like, don't tell us everything you know about movies, but why did you pick movies?
Yeah, okay, so, hey everybody. Everybody else stepped out of the room. It's just you and me now. I'm Caitlin. Nice of you to join me on my podcast now.
Help, she's taken over.
Yeah, shush, get back in your closet. Get back in there. Yeah, so I went to college with all of these people that you listen to on a weekly basis. And
bi-weekly, it's every other week.
Bi-weekly.
Oh, on a bi-weekly basis. and I studied cinema while I was there, and I really fell in love with movies. I wanted to be a filmmaker since, like, early high school, actually. Our English teacher made us write a paper about what we wanted to be when we grew up, and I wanted to write a paper about something fun, so I wrote about movies because I thought that would be more fun than the medical career that all of my other classmates chose, and it was, and I've stuck with that now for 10 plus years. So, yeah, I really like all different kinds of movies. My favorite movie is a very hard question to answer that Hannah asked me. Oh, sorry, that Cleo asked me. but I see right now it's The Dressmaker. I really like that one. It's on Amazon Prime. If you have access to that, totally go watch it. It's
amazing. Should go watch that.
Yeah.
You should. It's fantastic. Kate Winslet is a goddess. All right.
We know this. There. This is obvious. Yes.
I'm also very nervous, but I have 3 drinks here, so I'm good.
Hey.
I have leftover Sonic shake, I have a glass of water because I am a consummate professional, and then I also have a little sampler of raspberry vodka that Rissa got me for Christmas. So we are covered on all fronts.
So usually we start off our podcast with a fun fact.
Ooh. Did anyone bring a fun fact? Because I did not.
I didn't.
I actually have one.
Thank God.
You say yours, Hannah, and then I have mine that'll kind of walk us into the colloquialism.
Colloquial? Yeah, no, the fun fact is this. They reanalyzed some bones found in the South Pacific during the 1940s, and they are pretty sure they're Amelia Earhart's.
Yes, yeah. Sally just said this to me!
Yes. Here's the thing, though. Back in the 40s, they're like, oh, this couldn't possibly be Amelia Earhart's bones. It turns out Amelia Earhart was built like Ronda Rousey. She's a brick house.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, so they found these bones and they're like,
I was not prepared for this news, Hannah.
Exactly. So these are too buff to be women's bones. Obviously, this can't be Amelia Earhart. But now that they're thinking about it, they're like, huh. Maybe they are Amelia Earhart's bones. So it is also possible that she went down farther north, so it could just be some other person's bones. But it is a possibility, and I'm kind of excited about it, honestly.
This is so exciting.
Yeah. Also, I need to pause you for a second and ask who on earth Ronda Rousey is. Should I know her?
She's an MMA fighter.
Okay.
She's awesome.
I assume she's awesome. But I have no idea who she is.
Also,
she's
okay,
no buffist.
She has strong arms to hold you at night.
Yeah. Anyhow, so without any further ado, I hand this over to Caitlin. We are in your hot little hands.
Ooh, they are little. I have very small fingers. I promise not to drop you. Oh god, there goes Marissa. I'm sorry. Okay, so here I kind of like a fun fact to bring that I it has nothing to do with what I actually want to talk about, but I do delight in this fun fact as well. Do any of you know why Hollywood, the idea, is set in Hollywood, California?
What? Because of an ancient curse.
Because it was cheaper to film there than anywhere else.
Because the sun is year-round and makes for better lighting?
Okay, all of those are pretty good answers, including the ancient curse.
Yes! Nice. But we're amazing at this.
And a couple of you actually aren't wrong. But the short answer...
Which one is the ancient curse, right?
You'll have to tune in to find out. Oh, good. Short answer is Thomas Edison.
What?
The long answer... is Thomas Edison was the first patent troll. He held one of the early patents for a camera and a viewing platform for early cinema. And so he tried to keep a chokehold on the industry from his villainous lair, I mean, headquarters in New Jersey.
Edison was nothing if not a capitalist.
Everything is legal in New Jersey.
Yes. So other filmmakers obviously wanted to make and show their own movies, but Edison was literally sending thugs to the showings.
Dude,
and was, suing hilarious. The directors hundreds of times.
Jeez.
So some filmmakers like Adolf Zukor, Carl Laemmle, Harry Cohn, and Harry Albert Sam Jack Warner all decided that they would move across the country, where they'd be far away from medicine's grasp and into a land of decent weather and sunshine year-round. And so they started film studios like the Warner Brothers, Columbia, Universal, Paramount, and forever changed the capital of movies.
That's amazing. That's they awesome. Literally, so Hollywood is in California. California exists the way that it does because people wanted to get far away from a grouchy old man in New Jersey.
Yeah, if Thomas Edison had just like been chill about it, New Jersey could have been the capital of movies.
That's so weird.
Look where they ended up now. They're the main exporter of spackle in the United States.
That's the boringest thing I can think of.
But I don't want to talk about Hollywood, not just yet. What I want to talk about today is the origins of cinema, the era of silent movies. I want to talk about the who, where, and what of how we got from Roundhay Garden to The Jazz Singer. This era is very often overlooked by modern movie fans, and it's not just for film buffs or cinema students. The silent era has something to offer to everyone, and I think it's a symbol of what lies ahead for the film industry.
Ooh,
really? Yes.
So thank you for coming to my TED Talk.
Awesome. That's literally what this entire podcast is. I'm settling in.
Yeah, cool. All right. Pull up some popcorn, get your Coke refill, because here we go. So
wait, before you start, can we just go through... I know you've seen, like, all of them, but have anyone else ever seen a silent movie here in this room?
Yes.
No.
I've seen exactly one. I saw The Passion of Joan of Arc, which was interesting because the words were also in French.
Nice. Science, what did you see?
Just a clip of a Chaplin film.
Oh, okay, okay.
Oh, I've seen clips of Chaplin, but never a whole film.
Yeah.
I think it was it was 15 minutes. I don't know if it was a whole film or not. It didn't feel like it, but it had an entire plot, so...
It could have been a whole film. They were often shorter. Cleo, have you seen any silent movies at all?
I've seen clips from Chaplin and The Birds and Birth of a Nation.
Yeah, so you'll be familiar with a couple of these names that I'm going to drop here in a little bit.
I've seen a few others by watching them over your shoulder when we were roommates.
Yes. The Birds
so I've seen
not...
parts of other films.
Yeah, The Birds is not a silent film. It's just black and white.
Yeah, I was going to say The Birds is... That's Alfred Hitchcock, right?
Yeah, that's like 40s, 50s.
Oh, that's right.
Okay.
Maybe even 60s.
Maybe I just watched it with the volume turned down low.
Can you imagine? You watch a movie on mute and you're like, good silent film.
Well done. I'm so impressed. The special effects were excellent for their era. Wow. And before I really get going, I do want to, like, just acknowledge the fact that I am talking about an entirely visual art form in an entirely audio format. So there is a little bit of a breakdown
before,
there.
So
great.
It's
never stopped
I think what I'll do is I'll send some clips and, like, you guys can maybe put it on a blog post or something if people are really interested.
That'd be great.
I can't find them.
Yes. Definitely doing that.
Anyway, all right, so. So, in the beginning. The problem with this is that the beginning of cinema is kind of fuzzy and filled with a lot of white men with a lot of differing opinions. Mm. Is the origin of cinema to be found in Edward Muybridge's Horse Photography in 1876? Or is it based in the magic lanterns that date well back into the Middle Ages? Or is it even possibly based in the zoetropes, which are those little wheeled tricks that spin around and show repeated motion? And those date all the way back to first century China. Wow. It's really difficult to say. I'm going to go with Muybridge's just because then I got to talk about horses. The governor of California in 1876 hired Muybridge to settle a bet about whether at any point during a horse's gallop were all 4 feet off the ground. Because apparently there was nothing better to talk about in 1876.
And apparently we didn't know that by this point in our history.
Also apparently, yes. So Muybridge, what he did is he set up a series of 12 cameras that would each take a single picture as a horse galloped by. So he came away with obviously 12 pictures in a row that showed the horse's gait through a couple rotations of gallop. And the governor won his bet. And it was noticed that if the pictures were played one after another in a single box or a frame, it looked like the horse was moving. But it would take another 12 years before the next step in the story of cinema. Louis Le Prince, who was a French artist and inventor, shot some of the earliest surviving films that we have today. He filmed Round Hay Garden. That was his first. It's a 2-second clip of his son and some family friends just walking on a lawn.
Wow.
From, let's see, let me do my math real fast, because I didn't write this down like an idiot. 1888.
I have a question.
Yes.
This is a GIF. That's not a question, it's a comment, but that was a GIF.
This is a GIF. They made GIFs!
Oh, yes, essentially it was a GIF. You can find it on Wikipedia, this one, that's how I found it. Just round hay, like, round and
I'm
then
I'm looking it up
hay,
immediately.
Like the, yeah, and it's just a couple people walking around a lawn, and it's only a couple frames long. But it's like, what, 150 years old at this point?
Jeez.
And we have it.
Wow.
Yeah. He also had a couple other clips, like Traffic Crossing Leeds Bridge is another one, which sounds exactly like it is. But Le Prince never really got his day in the sun, though, because he mysteriously vanished from a train in 1890.
What?
What?
I'm sorry.
His body and luggage were never found.
Seriously,
he was traveling from US back to England to have a public showing of his like fancy moving images, and he disappeared on the train. Was Thomas Edison involved? Who's
frick?
To say?
Definitely.
Where was the train?
It was like somewhere in the middle US.
I was gonna say on the train tracks.
You said he was traveling from England to the US on train.
No, the other way. He was in the U.S., and he was traveling from the U.S. to England.
Okay. So he was trying to get to the shore.
Yes.
The New Jersey cinema mob.
I think this needs to be a film. We need to make a film about the New Jersey cinema mob. Let's go. Let's get it off the ground.
Thomas Edison sitting there smoking a pipe like, you know what to do. Like, you got it, boss.
Exactly.
Yeah, so that's really how cinema started, was like how proper cinema started. It's just setting up a camera at something and filming it for as long as you had footage for, which back
wasn't
in that
long.
Time was not long at all, no. 1891 is when cinema takes another step up. And this is when our dear old friend Thomas Edison enters the scene. He and his vastly more talented engineers contributed a lot in the early days of cinema.
So much shade.
I have. Yes. I'm keeping my opinions about Tommy E really close to the chest in this one. So he filmed his films in what is called a Black Mariah, which is a train car looking building that is painted entirely black and covered in tar paper, but the ceiling would lift entirely off. So that way they could get as much light into the room as possible, and that all of the light would be extraneous light would be absorbed by the black paper, and then the subjects would be really well lit.
Huh.
Oh, that sounds terrifying.
Yeah, so
does anyone still use those?
No, because they are incredibly expensive and pointless.
Okay.
Yeah. If you're ever watching a silent film and you're kind of wondering if it's a Tommy E picture, makes him sound like a rapper. No, dog, this is a Tommy E original. Here's these people kissing. Yeah. Nailed it. So it's often his subjects are pretty well exposed, but in the background and anything around them is just completely black. It's like they're operating in a vacuum a little bit. Huh. So he films.
That's kind of artistic. Like, I realize it's a necessary choice lighting wise, but it's also kind of artistic.
Yeah. He filmed some really weird stuff too. He filmed like some bits of vaudeville acts and some dances. He filmed a couple kissing, which was very scandalous.
Scandal.
He also filmed some cats boxing, which is delightful. Yeah.
Cat video!
1894 is when we got our first cat video, ladies and gentlemen.
Fantastic.
It did not take long. So the movies that he shot in his studio were shown to the public in kinetoscope parlors, which, if you're thinking about what a kinetoscope looks like, I basically want you to imagine a VR set, boop, on your eyes, but it is set in a box. So you kind of have to lean over and, like, turn a crank, and you'll watch this moving image turn in front of you.
Yes.
Yeah. They were big, and they were boxy, and it was a one-man show. They were kind of called peep shows a little bit. Like, there were some scantily clad women. I know. The public would pay 25 cents, and then they could look into five different kinetoscopes. And that was kind of all Edison.
It's a pretty hefty price for the day.
I mean, but to look at five of them.
Oh. 25 cents to look at five gifts.
Step Black right up, ladies gifts. And gentlemen.
Please call your congressman about net neutrality.
Yes, please.
Oh my gosh, it's so true.
Oh, please. That was what Edison thought cinema should be, was a one-person viewing experience. He was very adamant that this was how moving pictures were meant to be shown, and that he specifically never explored any other possible viewing methods.
Because they wouldn't be as lucrative.
That kind of sucks.
Yeah. But luckily, Edison was not the only person on the case, or we'd all be watching Black Panther in a Nickelodeon. The first known iteration of what an average person would recognize as a movie screening happened on December 28th, 1895, in Paris, France.
Nice.
The Lumiere brothers, Louis and Auguste, projected a series of their movies and charged one franc. The screening lasted approximately 25 minutes and featured many everyday scenes. Most notably, one of them was of a train arriving to a station. It's kind of coming at the camera. And the audience was extremely unnerved by this. They thought the train was coming right at them. Like, some of them, like, got up and, like, moved away in terror. Like,
that's great.
It's really amusing to picture a room full of very rational Victorians frightened by a black and white image on a screen. And I think it's really hard for, like, us as a modern audience to understand why that was, like, scary to them, just because, I don't know, there's nothing I don't feel like has come about in our lifetimes that it was so revolutionary as cinema was to
See Sharkboy and Lavagirl in 3D?
Oh my gosh.
Oh my god.
I was going to say, think back to the first time you saw something in 3D.
I think the first thing I saw in 3D was actually in Disney World. They had 3D stuff
like
there.
Yeah, like Muppets 3D.
And it scared me. But it was because I was a very small child and they were very large bugs and it wasn't great.
Oh, that one? No, I watched that one as an adult and I swear I will never go in there again. I will never set foot in that tree again.
So despite this monumental showing, the Lumiere brothers would not be the pioneers of cinema as an art form or really as a storytelling device.
Aww.
Technologically, cinema owes to them a great deal, but they thought that moving images would just be a fad. That people wouldn't want to pay to see things that they could just see with their own eyes for free. Louis Lumiere himself had a really famous quote that says, "Cinema is an invention without a future."
Oh my god. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Luckily, someone else was at that very fateful showing in 1895, and he saw cinema for what it could be. Enter into the scene, Georges Méliès.
Oh no.
I've heard that.
I've heard this name. I know this name because I watched Hugo one time.
Correct. Yes, he is the person who inspired Hugo, the story.
Huh. On a really bad date. Anyway.
He did the one with the moon in that thing.
He did the one with the moon in that thing. he was a stage magician at the time, and after watching the showing of the Lumiere brothers, he immediately jumped into the world of cinema. Within 4 months after that showing, his theater was regularly showing movies that he had made.
That's awesome.
He developed his own camera and his own methods for developing film because he was in Britain, where a lot of other people were in Paris. Yes, so he didn't have other people around him to help build, like, to help him technologically. He figured out a lot of this himself. He went on to go build his own movie studio that was made entirely of glass to capture all of the light possible.
Dang.
Yeah, it was called Star Films, which is really... I really like Georges Méliès. He's just got, like, a lot of aesthetical things going for him that I'm just a big fan of. Between the years of 1896 and 1913, he directed over 500 movies.
Wow.
What?
Yeah. He took his magician background and brought it to cinema. His movies are some of the earliest examples that we have of horror and science fiction. They feature dramatic...
special effects, right?
Yes. He is cinema's first special effects director, as we would call. He's kind of like... George Lucas for the silent era.
Nice.
That's awesome.
Hey, how long are we talking for these films?
Some of them vary wildly. His early stuff is like a minute long at most, but his later things are 45 minutes to an hour.
Dang.
Yeah. He got he started in 96 and then he worked till 13. Like that, those first 15 years of cinema saw enormous growth and change.
Was he the first to really use like a plot?
Actually, no. That was a woman who did that.
Okay.
Alice Guy Blachet, who was in Paris at the time, was a contemporary of Georges Méliès, and she directed the first narrative cinema piece. Because before her, it was very much just everyday life, like documentaries almost. Just
wait. So, what was the narrative?
It is called. Let's see. I think I have it here. It's called like the Cabbage Patch Fairy or something.
Aww.
Yeah, I know. It's this lady and she like does a dance and she like pulls babies out of cabbage patches and awesome. And there's like a little story.
I was wondering, did George, what's his face?
Méliès.
Did he, so he had more than one person watching his movies at a time. It was more like a theater than just.
Yes, he showed a lot of his films in theater, like a vaudeville theater that he owned and acted in himself. So it's more closer to a traditional movie screening like we would think of it. He wasn't using Edison's kinetoscopes.
Nice.
Yeah, and towards the later half of his career, most people were, just because they realized, oh, we can get more people to pay at once to see one showing versus just one at a time.
Nice job, Edison. Yeah. You think you're a capitalist? Try this on for size.
Mass production.
Some of Georges Méliès' like stylistic, I don't know, things that you can see in a lot of his pictures are really dramatic theater sets, and then also people disappearing and reappearing in frame, whether it's set pieces or people or just and it happened because he was filming on a street, just a normal documentary kind of shot, and his camera jammed and then it started filming again, and so when he went to look at the footage, it looked like the people on the street had disappeared and then new people had reappeared in the place.
Oh, fun.
Nice.
Yeah, so that sort of invention and something that he's really famous for just kind of happened by accident. But, you can see it in all of his movies. He uses it a lot because he's telling really fantastical tales. And so, obviously, people have to magically appear and reappear, and it's great.
Of course.
Everyone should watch A Trip to the Moon or Le Voyage dans la Lune. I took French in high school, so I'm going to trot it out here a little bit.
Thank goodness someone on this podcast can pronounce French.
Where were you the entire time I was giving episodes of French history?
Oh, dear. Oh, no.
I'm sorry again.
Oh, no. Yeah, everyone should watch that movie. It's only 15 years long. It's only 15 minutes long, but it is a landmark in early cinema. The image of the man in the moon with a rocket in his eye is iconic imagery, and it's on Netflix. So,
and they really show that's the one they show in Hugo, right?
Yes, that is the one that's in Hugo.
Such a pretty movie.
I love that movie. Towards the end of his career, Méliès started falling into debt. So much so that he could not afford to keep making movies. And then, heartbreakingly, during World War I, the French army confiscated over 400 original prints of his movies and melted them down to recover the silver and celluloid and turned them into heels for army shoes.
No!
That is the worst thing I've ever heard.
Yeah. It's heartbreaking.
Why did they need silver shoes?
No. They needed the celluloid for the heels. I think they just needed the silver to have it for something military related. I mentioned Georges Méliès for a couple of reasons. One, his work is some of the best preserved and accessible early cinema out there. I have a DVD compilation of his movies. Trip to the Moon's on Netflix. You can find a lot of his things on YouTube. And I mention him too because his story is really all too common for many of his contemporaries. Men and women poured their lives into this early art form. They helped to build the language of cinema. And then more often than not, they and their work were swept away as war and new innovation came along. It's really frustrating how much was lost. Like, we don't have a vast majority of the first feature-length movie ever made.
Dang.
Only a few clips of Alice Guy's later work remains. Like, even popular later movies like Metropolis, we don't have a full edit of. And at this point, we probably never will.
Sucks.
It's just... this is the, frustrating thing that I find about studying history, is just how incomplete the picture is.
Mm-hmm.
I remember when I was a kid, I rode my bike down to the library because I was 11 and lived in a small town, and I was obsessed with ancient Egypt at the time because I was 11 and, what else am I going to do?
Yeah, that's what you do.
Yeah. So I went to the library because I wanted to find a CD of what the music in the temple sounded like.
Oh, no.
And the librarian had to explain to me that we don't know and we can never know. And I was just, I actively remember just being like, oh, okay.
Oh, no.
Was so disappointed by that.
Poor younger
Caitlin.
I know. Yeah, I'm pathetic. It was, so I get that same feeling now. It's just like, and this stuff is way more recent than ancient Egypt. We should have known. But cinema in this era was seen as something super lowbrow, something for the masses. It wasn't art. It wasn't even really important. It wasn't meant to be saved. It's That's my very eloquent refute to those people.
I'm with you.
Thank
Same.
You. Same. Anyway. Okay, back to the story of cinema. So the period between 1895 and 1910 or so was a great period of exploration. The Lumières and even Méliès' works were dominated by a setup camera, and then they would have someone do something in front of said camera, kind of like a play. It took 3 years before we even got the first edit, which is the cutting of two different images together into one sequence. 1903 saw the first hit movie,
First edit, which means that all of the previous movies were done in one one shot?
Yes, correct.
Holy crap!
Yeah. That was in 1888, so it was only 3 or 4 years that we first first edit. Yes.
Okay, go on. Sorry.
Yeah, you're good. No, it's kind of weird that they went so long without being what if we shot over here a little bit, and then we shot over there, and we put it together? It took them a while to figure that out. But in this time period, they are building a language. Because cinema, it's kind of art, but even more than that, it is a language. It's how you visually communicate story. And so the better you are at that, the more eloquent you are in the language. And in this first 15 years, they were just writing, "See, Dick, run. Run, Dick, run. Run, run, run."
That's a good comparison.
Yes. 1903 saw the first hit movie, which was The Great Train Robbery. It was a 12-minute movie that featured action sequences and cross-cutting and panning and the earliest known example of someone firing at the feet of someone else to make them dance. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. So these first few years are really interesting to me because it was truly a wild west. Like, no one had really figured out quite how to make it a sound investment yet. There was just a whole lot of experimentation. So we see a lot of women filmmakers in this time. Like, Alice Guy was exceptionally prolific, and she was not the only one. And even we see scenes of gay and lesbian people also at this time, because this was way before the Hays Code. This was before the field was dominated by the studios and men. Women especially contributed heavily to early cinema. And then I already talked about Alice Guy, because we got to there first. she was the first to tell a story. But eventually, people realized that these movies weren't just a sideshow anymore. They weren't just an attraction. They were popular with the masses. And so that is when we see the men and the studios step in and dominate.
Because money.
Because money, exactly. Mm. The second half of this 30-year period, frankly, doesn't interest me as much, but that doesn't mean it's not important. We can see the language get more refined, and visuals are getting better at conveying emotion and importance. It makes sense for the movies to grow during this time after World War I. The whole world has just been traumatized, and what better way to ignore how you feel than by sitting in a darkened room for an hour or two? I've never done that before, ever. And then as we move into the 20s, the movies become a reflection of the breakneck speed of culture at that time.
Oh my gosh, it was crazy. It was crazy.
It was nuts. we see the stories get bigger and grander. W.D. Griffith, who is a giant racist, his The Birth of Nation was 3 hours long and the first movie to be screened in the White House. That came out in 1915. Awkward. And it's really horrifying when you know that that movie literally caused the KKK to be reformed. Thanks, David D. Griffith.
Let's not do that, ever.
What is the plot of The Birth of the Nation?
The plot of Birth of the Nation is set in... It's either set in or right before the Civil War, but it is about a group of African-American men who are sexually aggressive towards white women, then the Ku Klux Klan rides in and saves them.
No!
Yeah, and of course, the African-American men were not played by African-American men, but were played by white people in blackface.
This is the worst!
Yes. If it makes you feel a little bit better, when the movie came out, already the NAACP was like, this is gross and bad, and no. They said it a lot better than that, but already people were like, this is not a good movie. Why did you make this movie? And so then D.W. Griffith turned around and made another movie called Intolerance, which was even bigger and even longer than Birth of a Nation, which was about how man has been intolerant against other men since the beginning of time, so you can't be mad at me.
Oh my gosh. Oh
yeah,
gosh.
It was not well received.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What president did they screen it for?
Woodrow Wilson.
Of course. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question about that.
Yes, please.
Because, obviously, the horrific nature of the content in this movie, but I've heard that D.W. Griffith used a film technique that no one had used up to that point.
He, at the end of his movie features an actual train going into a ravine and exploding, which is quite fantastic.
Wow.
But I know that in Intolerance he shot using different sepia colors for the different eras, because there's an ancient Babylonian era, a Napoleon era, and then another one that I'm forgetting. But they're all shot, one of them's blue, another one's kind of more a brown, and the other one's
black
and white.
Maybe it was that instead, because I just remember hearing something about him using something that they hadn't done. But yeah, the parts of Birth of Nation I've seen, I just were like, not only is it propaganda, but it's, like you said, it's really bad propaganda.
Yeah, it's super racist propaganda. It's just, W.D. Griffith was raised in Tennessee. He's kind of a man of his culture. It's really unfortunate because, this is a landmark film, even though it's terrible. And so I've never watched the whole thing, but I've, watched bits of it
now,
you did.
We're still in silent film, though, right?
Yes, yes.
Okay.
This is still,
I'm just
making
sure.
1915. Yeah, 1915. Oh, wow, okay. Okay. So in this period, also, Cecil B. DeMille took his first crack at the Ten Commandments. And the montage was invented by the Russians during this time, by Sergei Eisenstein. If you've ever heard of Battleship Potemkin, that is a really famous example of Russian montage, which basically Montage is the idea of putting two disparate images that are not connected, and together their combination creates a third idea.
Interesting.
So we studied this in my film classes by, and it's a really great example of montage, is it's a shot of a man and he has a completely neutral expression. And then shown after that is a bowl of soup. And you get the idea that the man is hungry and he wants the soup. Or you see this man and then he's looking at a baby and you, and then, well, like, he's not looking at a baby, it's just a picture of a baby. And so you get the idea that, oh, he loves the baby, he's protecting the baby. So that's what montage started with. So Battleship Potemkin is really famous for this sequence of a baby carriage falling down a step of stair, a large staircase, while there's, like, a giant revolution happening in, I'm guessing, Moscow? I watched it back probably in junior year. It was a long, long time ago.
At that point, it was everywhere.
Yes, at that point, it was everywhere. Actually, no, the Russians didn't like Battleship Potemkin. They didn't like the Russian montage. They were like, they had already been used to and so preferred the more emotional, kind of heavy-handed drama style of Hollywood at this time. So Sergei Eisenstein wasn't liked by the Russians, but he is admired by film students everywhere. So, you know, I guess he got the last laugh.
That's what's really important here.
During this time, also, the studio system began, where Adolf, Carl, and Harry, that were mentioned way back at the beginning, could make or break a person's career. So stars rose, ticket sales grew, and then the sound kicked on. The Jazz Singer was originally planned as another silent movie, but with six songs with synced audio. But it was Al Jolson who improv some dialogue between songs that became the death knell for the silent era. Oh. He says, and it is iconic at this point, he says, now wait a minute, you ain't heard nothing yet. Which is,
oh, I've heard wow, that.
Could not have been timed better. Warner Brothers had invested $3 million outfitting their theaters to be able to play this new soundtrack. And just for some comparison, that's over $42 million in today's money.
Wow.
Everybody in Hollywood thought they were idiots and were going to lose their shirts. But the film,
how'd that work out?
The film was a resounding success. And then quickly, every other studio in Hollywood rushed to outfit their own theaters for sound.
It's a shame that Al Jolson played the role in blackface.
Yes, that is also a big old bummer.
Anyway.
Yeah. So obviously it wasn't an overnight change. Silent movies were still made for a few years afterwards just because they were cheaper. But by and large, they were dying on the vine. A few actors and filmmakers were able to make the jump to sound, but the vast majority of them were left behind and replaced with new people. And a new era started for film.
So did the first audience know they were going to see a talking picture? Or did they just walk in and boom, sound?
Because the Jazz Singer, it both was the first talkie movie and also wasn't the first talkie movie. Warner Brothers released, I think the year before, Don Juan with a synced, recorded soundtrack. It was all music, and it was recorded by the New York Philharmonic Symphony. So audience before had seen, it was kind of like a big spectacle that, oh, hey, there's synced audio with this one, and was like, oh, okay, yeah, let's go see that one. Kind of like IMAX is today, where it's like, oh, hey, that movie's in IMAX, yeah, let's go see it. So I think they knew beforehand that it was going to be synced singing. The dialogue was not planned, though, and I think that really captured people's attention, because after the end of every single song, and there are six songs in the movie, the audience applauded and rose to their feet, standing ovation. Wow. Everybody loved it.
Wow.
The rest is history.
That's kind of cute.
So,
I mean, I'm just imagining people doing that every time the Imperial March ends, which is applause.
Yeah, they're just losing their
minds.
What are you
talking about? People don't do that usually?
Yeah, no. Ken, are you one of those people who claps when the plane lands?
Listen.
Get out of here.
Aww. This is Caitlin's podcast now.
Yes, it's my podcast. Look at me. I'm the podcast host now.
Next time you invite Caitlin. So I have a question and a concern.
Okay, yes, question?
Question and concern. Concern is, I tried looking it up on Netflix, and I cannot find A Trip to the Moon, and I'm wondering if they took it down.
I literally watched it, French, like, a week ago.
Okay, I'm just having trouble finding it. But the question was, you haven't really talked about what I thought I knew to be your favorite movie.
Oh, Metropolis?
Yeah, you mentioned it really briefly, and I wanted to hear more about that. Where does that fit in the story? When did that happen?
Yes, Metropolis is a 1927 German impressionistic film. It is one of the earliest examples of sci-fi science fiction. I'm trying to remember the guy who made it, but I can't. I didn't mention it just because it came out in Germany, which I haven't really talked about so far, German cinema. And it came out in 1927. So it was really at the very tail end of silent movies, that, 'cause The Jazz Singer came out in 1927.
Okay.
But it's, I watched it in cinema class, for a couple different reasons. One, it is the movie to have the most extras ever to date.
Really?
And
now
really.
we just use digital people to fill in the background.
I mean, yeah, we use digital people and Q-tips. Do you guys know that about episode one of Star Wars?
What?
Yes.
The crowd scenes for the pod race in the first episode of Star Wars, what they did is they painted Q-tips and stuck them in special holders and then ran like fans and blow dryers beneath them so they would move around and it looks like a crowd. So those crowds actually aren't digitally reproduced. It's the one visual effect that they did for that movie. Yeah. But yeah, Metropolis is also on Netflix, because I watched that one while I was prepping for this, because it's just, it's a really interesting movie. It's got some fun score. It's about this guy whose father basically runs all of the world, and he is the richest, and he plays in the Garden for Sons, because the titans of this world have built this beautiful paradise for their children to live in. And then one day, while he is frolicking with beautiful ladies in the Garden of Sons, a woman comes in with, surrounded by a crowd of children that are the children of the workers who live down in the workers' city. And the man is like, who are these people? What do you mean? What? And he goes down in the workers' city and sees the plight of the man, and then helps to, like, overthrow the system. He pulls a Katniss, and and at one point, the woman turns into a robot, and, like,
what?
There's definitely full frontal nudity in that film, so.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, I remember the two things I remember that I've seen of this. Okay, three. I've seen one scene with a lot of extras in, one scene with a guy with, like, a clock or something, and then this scene with this woman who kept doing this awkward chest grab on herself.
Yep.
And we were just like, how many times can you grab your own breast in one scene?
Oh, you're right. They did take A Trip to the Moon off Netflix.
I know.
One time I drank too many peach vodkas and I sent them a complaint about how there was dialogue in The Trip to the Moon. So maybe they listened to that.
And took it down. You're the reason.
I'm so sorry. Yeah, I watched it on my DVD compilation. It used to be on Netflix. You can find it on YouTube. It is definitely on YouTube. Metropolis is still on Netflix.
Yeah, that's true.
Okay. Yeah. And that film also has, Metropolis has some, like, ginormous sets built, and some really dramatic lighting. It's really interesting. I quite like it. I also just enjoy silent movies overall because I can say the dialogue that I want to and nobody goes, shh.
I love it.
Yeah. So, here, I have, like, a fun little conclusion. So you got the approximate who, the what, and the how, but why?
That was what I was going to ask.
Exactly. Well, I think that while the silent movie era is long over, it is still worthy of being viewed. For a filmmaker like myself, it is important to study where we began and where we have come from. But for people who just like movies, they're important because they're good movies. As I prepped for this, I watched a lot of different ones, and they still made me laugh. They still made me feel over 100 years later. I don't know if we can say that about the movies we're making today, that they will still be appreciated by people 100 years from now.
Hmm.
And also, to watch them is a practice in empathy. You can't just passively sit back and look at your phone because you'll miss the story. You have to pay attention and you have to emote with the characters. Silent movies invite you to step in and fill in the gaps where the lack of dialogue leaves you.
Hmm.
But most importantly, I believe that silent movies are still important because they are a roadmap to what is coming for the industry. Ooh. The silent era was marked by experimentation and exploration and growth. No one country or one studio dominated. And with the advent of affordable yet high-quality film equipment like DSLRs and Adobe Creative Cloud, and the ability to get one's work in front of a large group of people thanks to the internet, we have entered into a similar era now. It's possible for anyone to make a movie these days. And so we are seeing more women filmmakers. We are seeing more people of color filmmakers. We are seeing more LGBT filmmakers getting their stories out there without having to kowtow to some studio. And I think that's amazing. The first century of cinema was a truly roller coaster ride. And I can't wait to see what the next one is going to hold.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
That's awesome. And yeah. Wow, you're right. Like, can you imagine if these people who were like, you know, making these really early videos and, oh, it's a fad, heard about mm-hmm. Vine?
Oh my gosh.
Back at it again at the Krispy Kreme.
Yeah. A cinematic masterpiece, as we all knew.
So if you enjoyed hearing about this brief and very incomplete origin of cinemas, I encourage you to go find it yourself. A lot of the films are available online on Netflix, YouTube, or even Wikipedia. And if jumping straight into silent movies seems kind of intimidating, go watch some movies about silent movies. Singing in the Rain is a classic Hollywood movie about the shift from silent to talkies. Hugo is a great movie about Georges Méliès. And if you're really, really intrigued by the topic, this is for the cool kids. You should definitely check out The Story of Film in Odyssey, which is a 15-part documentary on Hulu about cinema.
Lord, amazing.
Yes, it is. It's really fantastic, though, because they did a great job of not just focusing on Hollywood and Western cinema. They talk about what cinema was doing in Japan. Japan cinema is huge. They talk about Bollywood. They talk about German cinema. They talk about African cinema, all of it. And it's narrated by an Irishman, and it's just great. So
that sounds awesome.
Excellent. I'm going to watch that.
Yeah. Watch that real hard.
Against my better judgment.
Go for it.
Are you binging the new series of Jessica Jones? No, I'm watching a 15-part documentary on film.
Can but you'll be imagine... so much more, like, sophisticated.
I've just been sitting here imagining binge-watching in the era of 15-minute films.
Oh yeah, I got a lot of them.
Okay, we live in the era of 6-second films, okay?
That's true. With full plots.
I know, but so I guess we just shouldn't be too surprised. Imagine you go into Thomas Edison's theater and you just keep throwing quarters down and you get a message that says, it's been 45 minutes, are you still watching?
I said again.
His giant thugs ask you to leave.
I was gonna say more like, it's been 45 minutes, you owe me another quarter.
Yeah.
Listen, lady, if you don't let someone else go, we're gonna kick you out ourselves.
No, but imagine if Edison had his way, but we still got long plot things. It's like,
oh, my word.
The plot goes 5 minutes, and then please insert a coin to see the rest.
Oh, no! Oh! No, I hate it.
Please contact your
congressman about net neutrality. Don't let the Thomas Edisons of the world win. Please.
Awesome. Thank you so much, Caitlin.
Yes, thank you.
That was really fun.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, silent cinema is awesome. I love it.
You're by far our best guest.
Yes.
Thank you so much. You like me. You really like me.
Oh, Cleo, do you have a post-grad problem for us?
No.
No? Who was supposed to have that?
No one ever came up with a post-grad problem.
Yeah.
We just sat around and was like, so who has problems? And no one ever said.
That's true.
Oh, I've got problems. I have lots of problems.
Yeah, would you like to share a post-grad problem with us?
Yeah, here we go. Here's my post-grad problem of the week. That has been my months. We have new neighbors that moved in next door.
Oh, no.
Ugh, I know about this.
For the past couple months, we did not have neighbors. We just had an empty apartment next to us. And since I'm aloft, I'm over stores, so it was fantastic. We didn't have to worry about being too loud. Like, there was never any noise. It was phenomenal, and I did not appreciate what I had till it was gone. Because then two white boys moved in next door, and I think all they moved in was a TV and a PS4 and a futon to sit on with their girlfriends. Because literally, from the moment they wake up till the moment they go to sleep, the office is running constantly. Ugh. Every 20 minutes.
I testified to this. I know this to be true.
They do not have any furniture in there because literally I can hear them talking in their kitchen, which is on the opposite side of the apartment from our shared wall.
I have visited Caitlin, and I can also attest that they tend to come into their house and turn on said TV around the time everyone else is going to sleep.
Yep.
Oh my god.
Like, I did not hear them until I was, like, going to bed, and suddenly it was like, oh, there's a TV on.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah, so like, 10 p.m. to, like, 4 a.m. every night.
Have you tried banging on walls?
See, like, the thing is that if they had furniture in their apartment, it's not like they're yelling at each other. One time they were playing Macklemore really loud because we could hear the bass through the walls, but like,
I mean,
and it's not like it's during quiet hours either, so like the things that they are doing are just obnoxious because like we have tall ceilings, we have wood floors, so the sound just echoes if you do not have staff to absorb it. Mm-hmm. And they do not, they cannot, from what I hear. And also they just talk really loudly to each other, like they're just having a normal conversation, but Natalie and I are sitting here, and we can hear every single word that they are saying.
You should start commenting.
You should just slip them a note that says, like, responds to them.
Buy a gosh darn rug. Okay, fun story. One night, Sunday night, they were listening to some, like, stupid rap music or whatever. Not that rap music is stupid. It's just, it's Sunday night, and I'm trying to chill. You know how it is. Am I right, ladies?
Yeah.
And they were playing it on their TV, I'm guessing, because we could hear it crystal clear through our wall. And so I turned on my Google Home Opera, which is,
yes!
And my Google Home is right next against the shared wall, and I kept turning it louder and louder and louder, and literally it's just the magic flute, like,
this is amazing.
And then they turned their music off, and so I turned it down.
Yeah!
I think they got the message.
You should just start, seriously, like Rissa said, you should just start sending the mail, like, Dear Joe, heard that you were trying to find a dentist, so may I recommend mine?
Yeah.
Dear Steven, I'm sorry about your bad breakup.
Dear Steven's girlfriend who always hangs out with them while they play Madden football and don't actually talk to her, honey, you can come next door. Like, we have chips and a couch.
You can, like, do come better, be honey. With us.
We will treat you way better than they will.
We have
the girls an A.
A completely furnished apartment.
Yes. And it's pretty adorable, if I do
we
say
have
so
more
myself.
Than you one should chair.
It is adorable.
So this is actually Operation Rescue Steven's girlfriend.
Yes. Yes, she deserves better.
What if you just bought them a rug?
I don't have a rug in my apartment. I'm not going
to
spend money on them.
No, like one of those $10 ones from Walmart or something.
No, no, no. What you do is...
No, no, you ding-dong ditch, and they open the door, and there's just a rug.
No, no, no.
With a body in it.
What you do is you go find some soundproofing service and print off a flyer and just slip it under their door.
Are there any non-passive-aggressive ways to ask your neighbors to cool it?
No.
I mean, you could knock on their door and confront them, but no.
That sounds like a thing I would do.
It is a thing you would do.
Yes,
I have a hard time telling school children who I have authority over to be quiet in class, so I don't think I could ever talk to a neighbor.
You gotta work on your authoritative power.
I used that today. So today, for the first time, I sent someone to the office.
I'm done. Okay. Send someone to the office? Or was that the end of the story?
Today, for the first time, I actually had to send somebody to the principal's office.
Ooh.
What did they do to merit
just
this?
Would not listen to me, wouldn't shut up, wouldn't stay in his seat, just really disruptive. And well, what happened was there were four people who I kept threatening, if you keep doing this, I will send you to the office. And I only ended up sending one of them. And afterwards, the other three were very good.
That's how
it works. You found the ringleader.
Exactly. Yeah, you did. You found the ringleader.
I just had to, like, wait long enough to figure out which one of them was the one and send him.
Nice.
Nice.
So you're my hero.
But no, today I did a lot of shh-ing.
My proud moment when I worked in middle school was mastering the across-the-room silent stare.
Oh, I wish I had that.
Oh, it's golden. There are a few moments more empowering when you can just look at someone across the room and the only thing they say is, "Yes, ma'am."
See, this is what I need to develop and just do not have it all.
It takes a while, though. You have to get a track record. Like,
yeah.
They have to take your word seriously. And then...
My main problem is confronting people who I feel sorry for. Like... Listen, there's this kid in my Sunday school class who is also disruptive and doesn't listen. But he's a class clown and I feel sorry for him.
Yeah, I get
that. I got in trouble in school. All I wanted to do was tell jokes.
You?
Some... What?
What?
I am shocked.
I know. Talking in school?
Yeah, I never got detention or anything, but I did get, like... a little warning flag next to my name. That was usually enough to get me to shut up.
Nice.
Yeah.
Caitlin was a good child.
Yeah, Caitlin was a good student because Caitlin wanted to get in college. Caitlin was thinking about college in fourth grade.
Wow.
Rissa wasn't even thinking about college junior year of high school, so.
Nope. Hannah barely thought about college in college. So what are we into this week?
Well, I'm into something. Yeah. So I bring this up. I actually wrote a blog post about this this week. Not on our shared blog. I have a personal blog of my own. And
you do things
I recently
us?
Got to fit. I know. I do things with just Caitlin, too. So, ha. We have a podcast.
It's not posting yet.
Seeing other podcasts.
Rissa, we've been discovered.
Because that's the worst thing that can happen when you're, like, publishing media, is that someone discovers you.
Yes. Our podcast must never be known. It is forbidden.
Keep it secret. The podcast we make just for us. I mean, at this point, that's exactly what it is. It's not even Skype, Caitlin. It is a phone call.
Yeah, it's a phone call.
I got to finish a novel for the first time in a long time recently.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, wow. Wow.
And this was an actual, like, paperback Reddit novel as opposed to an audiobook. So I've gotten to engage with a lot of fiction over the past couple of years. Games, films, a lot of audiobooks. But it's been a long time since I've actually read a book that is a novel. I've been reading a lot of mythology books recently, but I wouldn't consider them novels. This one is mythology adjacent. It's George MacDonald's Lilith. I call it mythology adjacent not because it has to do with any specific mythology, but because I read it because it's been called a myth, a modern myth. So I read this book because C.S. Lewis, my favorite author, recommended it, basically. He had a couple authors that he really loved. Now, the thing is, this sounds awful, and I'm super disappointed either in myself or in the world at this fact. Almost every other book I have read on C.S. Lewis's somewhat recommendation, I haven't liked that much. Oh.
I tried a George MacDonald, an abridged version of a George MacDonald work, and it was one of the worst things I've ever read.
One that's really, really good, and it surprised me. So why I wanted to talk about it was that I was surprised that I liked this novel so much. I think it starts out a bit like Phantasties. The first kind of third, I was really worried that this would just end up another... When I say plot, it's like a series of events, but they're not really linked in anything except that they happen in sequence. And it feels like they could have happened in another sequence, except they just didn't. But eventually you find the plot. But anyway, the thing I really enjoyed about this was basically the same thing that brought me to it. It's one of these books that you read it, and while you're reading, you can tell everyone else who's read it. It's like you're reading it with everyone else you've ever read.
Oh, it's like there reading were... Dune. It's like source material.
Yeah, and I'm not saying that everyone else stole from Lilith, and I'm not saying Lilith was the first, because it's obviously not. George MacDonald was himself very familiar with lots of, like, deeper source material. But as I was reading, it's like, even individual lines, you could see that, like, this line, Lewis Carroll had to have read this line. This line, Terry Pratchett and Neil Gaiman have definitely read this. And it's not like I've ever heard them talk about it, but they have definitely read it. And it was just a really fun experience to be reading a book. And, like, even though I've only ever heard Lewis mention MacDonald by name, and I haven't even heard him mention Lilith, just MacDonald, I can tell that Lewis and Tolkien and Pratchett and Gaiman and Carroll and everyone else has read this book, and I can point out lines and be like, this is maybe not where they got it, but you can, it's almost like you can see the light bulbs in other people's heads turn on when you read this book. And I really enjoyed it.
I'm gonna have to check that out.
Yeah.
It has a interesting perspective on the afterlife and some other stuff. But
this isn't theology, is what you're saying.
Well, it is, and that's part of its problem. It is theology, and it's theology that not everyone would agree with.
Ah.
And when I say everyone, not everyone within Christianity would agree with.
Ah.
George MacDonald is a universalist, and not everyone likes that.
Ah.
Anyway. But it's a good book.
Thank you for the rec, Rissa.
Mm-hmm.
So, thank you all for listening. Thank you to Caitlin Thompson for our graphics and design.
And the colloquium, and a fun fact, and a postgrad problem.
Basically, you did the whole show today, and we'd like to thank you for that.
I told you, this is my podcast now, so, you know.
The one thing in this whole show you didn't do is our intro and outro music.
That's true, which was done by Tristan from Vintage Lab Tech. Thank you, Tristan. We also wanted you guys to know that 2 days after this episode is posted, we will be appearing on the show Best Forevers, which is done by our friend and fellow research enthusiast, Elisa. She is great, and we're pretty great, so you should go listen to that episode. It's going to come out on Friday.
Before we, like, close up, can we just tell them the name of Caitlin in my podcast whenever
Absolutely.
It gets episodes?
Yes.
Yeah, if you really enjoyed hearing the dulcet sounds of my voice, be sure to tune in to Weedin' from the Chaff. Okay, Rissa and I have a podcast called Weedin' from the Chaff, where we take a look at progressive media through the decades with a critical eye, especially at Joss Whedon's work. And it is
definitely, definitely not a Buffy the Vampire Slayer podcast.
Yeah.
Nope.
It's it'll show up one of these days. Maybe I should finish editing the first episode. Oh well.
But it'll be good when it does.
Take
yes.
it from some podcast professionals. You do in fact need to finish editing episodes.
What? Ugh. It's the worst.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Caitlin.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
This was really fun.
Yeah.
Would you care to close us out?
Yeah, until next time, watch something worth seeing.
Oh,
oh nice.
What up, like what it. Up? And I just dabbed. You can't tell, but I did dab.